When we think about noteworthy persons of the Old Testament, I'm sure we probably think of Abraham before very long, and perhaps Job, maybe David, or some of the prophets. But two of the most faithful individuals in the Old Testament, at least as seen through the eyes of Scripture, were Joseph and Daniel. In fact, the interesting thing about those two men is that in contrast to Abraham, whose faults at times are displayed in the Scriptures, David the same way, and even Job, who sins with his mouth in his conversations with his friends, I don't know that the Scriptures say anything negative about either Joseph or Daniel. What's even more surprising about that is that we don't meet these individuals when they are grown men and men of maturity and perhaps even in the middle age, but both of them, we meet them when they are still young men, perhaps even teenagers in the case of Joseph for certain, and Daniel most likely also. Now, what's interesting about that last fact is that it is really almost a foregone conclusion among a lot of people, and particularly in our country and time, that youthful indiscretion is inevitable. That young people are just going to mess up their lives. You just have to expect that. It's part of growing up. But not in the life of Daniel. Not in the life of Joseph. And that makes them extraordinary individuals, at least from the standpoint of the way our society looks at youth. If I'm not mistaken, I read just recently that in the federal government's budget that is being bandied about now for the future, that all funding for abstinence programs in schools is going to be cut. And the reason that you'll see given for that from time to time is simply this. Abstinence programs don't work. The idea is that supposedly it is inescapable that young people are going to be promiscuous, that they're going to have sexual relations outside of marriage. It's assumed that there's no way to stop that, and so rather than try to prevent it, what we try to do is help them cope with their youthful indiscretions. And I'll tell you what, when we start with that attitude, the battle is lost before it's begun. And frankly, that's just not the case. That's not true. Young people can live good moral lives. And I would suggest our young people is a good example of that. This morning in the sermon, we looked at the method that was used by the Pharisees to combat worldliness. Some of you may not have been here this morning, but what we said was that the Pharisees, at least over a period of time in the New Testament, were really looking at the end game, the result of this process or this method. But the method was that we'll take the law and we'll make a lot of other regulations and rules that kind of form a hedge around that law. And that's how we'll keep people faithful to the law. We'll just tell them how the law applies in every situation. And then pretty soon those laws, those little regulations, they become the law and even sometimes supplanted the divine law. And the sad part about it is that it really didn't work. It was a failure, this method used by the Pharisees. But I'm here to tell you that it is possible to live a pure life, an acceptable life before God in an unclean world. And I want to talk to you about that tonight. But I want to show you the flip side of the coin. This morning what we did is we looked at the Pharisees primarily in a negative way to say, well, now this is what they did and here's how it turned out. Don't do that. But what I want to do tonight is I want to look at the book of Daniel, specifically at the life of Daniel and the three friends, the other three Jewish men who are mentioned in Daniel chapter 1 and chapter 3. And I want to demonstrate how it is that we can live good moral lives in an unclean world. And I'll tell you what, although young people are often depreciated by society in general as not being very smart, not being very spiritual, and pretty much destined to some sort of moral disaster, what we're going to do tonight is learn from young people how to resist the devil. And we're going to talk about Daniel and his three friends. We really need to begin by talking a little bit about Daniel's circumstances. And some of this, I assume, will be review for some of you, but bear with us just briefly. Daniel, of course, was living during the time of the end of the southern kingdom of Judah. Nebuchadnezzar is going to come and he's going to take three groups of exiles away. The last group that he takes will be at the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. But Daniel was actually taken in the first group in 605 BC. And he was taken back to the city of Babylon along with three other Jewish young men who are mentioned. And their Jewish names are Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But we know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I threaten to name my sons Shadrach and Meshach Devorah. And Deb canceled that. But those are their names, and they were part of a select group of young men, including Jews, who were going to be trained, specially trained in the language and the literature of the Chaldeans, the text says, so that they would be equipped to serve in the king's palace. And so Daniel and his three friends really are in somewhat of a privileged position, but it's kind of an unfortunate position also because they are captives. They've been taken from their own land, taken from the society that they're used to, and they have been transported into what I'm going to call an unclean world or an unclean land. Because so much of what was around them was foreign to them in terms of keeping the covenant of the Lord. In fact, just the names that they are given by the Babylonians are connected to false gods. And so Daniel and his friends are living in a world that is an unclean land surrounded by ungodliness. But you know something we need to think about? The reason that Daniel has been taken to Babylon is because God is punishing his people. You see, things weren't all that good in Judah. We could even argue, based on some of the literature of Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Lamentations, Habakkuk, we could argue that things weren't much better in Judah than they were in Babylon. That in fact the Jews had assimilated so much of the wickedness and the culture of the nations around them that God is now causing the land to vomit them out, even as it did the previous inhabitants back when Israel took the land from the Amorites, as they are called in general. Have you ever thought about that? And I want to emphasize to you tonight how difficult it would be for Daniel to be in Babylon and to stay pure and to keep faithful to God in the midst of a culture that's unfaithful, but he came from a culture that was unfaithful. And that's what makes it so amazing, is that before Daniel ever got to Babylon, he was a good man. Probably in his teens or early 20s at the latest, Daniel served a long time, as the book of Daniel demonstrates, one of the longest serving prophets, if not the longest serving prophet, in the Old Testament, at least as far as we're aware of. So he began very young in this book when he was taken as a captive, but he was already an individual committed to living a pure life. He'd come from a cesspool and moved to an unclean land. Very soon, apparently, after their arrival in Babylon, Daniel and his three companions, along with apparently some others, were soon faced with the decision about whether to eat the food that was being supplied to this group by the king. They were being specially trained. They were being specially provisioned by the king so that they were allotted the king's delicacy and wine to drink with their food. But apparently, some of the food and perhaps also the drink that the king was providing, the king's delicacies as it is described in Daniel 1, that food was unclean according to the Mosaic law. Daniel said, or purposed in his heart in verse 8 of chapter 1, that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies. Now, just eating food that's been provided by a king doesn't defile you. Might be a really good diet. But apparently it was the nature of the food that it was prescribed, prohibited by the law of Moses. And Daniel decides he's not going to be defiled by this food. Now, something we need to remember is that these young men were in a very privileged situation. The Israelites, back when they were in Egypt, way back in the history of Jacob's family and the expansion into a nation, they didn't serve in Pharaoh's palace. They were making bricks and building cities for the Egyptians. They were doing hard labor, hard physical labor. But Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, they're going to live in the palace and serve the king. It is going to be a much better lifestyle than probably many of the other captives were going to face. And I only bring that point up so that you remember how much Daniel stands to lose if he washes out of the program. Some of you engineers know that expression. And so Daniel may have done like some people occasionally do, and that is try to figure out some way that we can accommodate the king and rationalize how we can eat this food that's unclean and keep our position. I'm sorry, I couldn't help it. I had to use a little bit of an anachronism here. I wonder if Daniel would have said like sometimes people say today, we've got too much to lose, you and me and these other three guys, to get all pharisaical about it. If you were here this morning, you know that that's a common view of Pharisaism, is that if you pay attention to details, if you're trying to be careful about your obedience to the law of God, that makes you a Pharisee, and that's false. That's not the error of the Pharisees. But using that language, that kind of language, Daniel may have argued like people do today, well, let's just not get all pharisaical about it. After all, we all love God, and we're trying to do the best we can to serve Him, and we'll just go ahead and eat this meat, but we're not, you know, it's not like we're serving other gods. You know, when you're among the Babylonians, live like the Babylonians. Or I guess if we were to use modern parlance, we would say, what happens in Babylon stays in Babylon, right? Or maybe he would have said, well, who knows about our choice? After all, most of the Jews are still back in Judah. Maybe their families were back there. And this seemed to be a fairly select group, even among the captives who have been taken in 605. So who's really going to know about this anyway? Or maybe a little unclean food can't possibly hurt. It's not like we're worshiping false gods. The big sin versus the little sin. This is a little sin. Yeah, we're talking unclean meats, maybe. We're not talking about idolatry or murder or adultery. Lighten up, Daniel. Or maybe he could have said, you know what? It seems like there are other Judeans who are not refusing to eat the unclean food and drink. Now, I'm going to make a couple of observations here very quickly. Number one, I'm focusing on Daniel, and yet it's apparent that his three companions were on the same page as he was with respect to his commitment to God and to the law. And secondly, it may be that there were others who likewise objected, and the Scriptures just don't make that observation, don't give us all that information. But you know, it's interesting that in verse 3, the king instructed the master of his eunuchs to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles. And then he describes what kind of people they're looking for. Young men in whom there's no blemish, good looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies. Now, verse 6, from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. When you read those verses, do you get the impression there were other Judeans who were in the same program? And that Daniel and his three friends are not the only ones who are faced with this decision. And Daniel and his three friends don't have to obey the law of Moses anymore. So then these other Judeans, none of these guys were sons of the king or apparently even nobles. So Daniel could have said, well, wait a second, guys, look at these other Judeans. They're not refusing the king's delicacies. So why should we? They'll get the privileged positions and we'll be out making bricks or doing some other kind of labor that we don't want to do. So having said that about the circumstances of Daniel's situation, make a couple observations, a couple things that seem to stand out and shout for attention in this story. The first is that Daniel purposed in his heart that he was not going to defile himself. I think it's a very significant statement. In verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, that's the second time we've read that verse. Have you noticed already that the second half of the verse is a consequence statement? Therefore, he requested. The decision not to defile himself was made before he went to the chief of the eunuchs to request that his diet be changed so that he didn't defile himself. And of course, the other three men are involved also. Did you see that? The very first thing he did was make up his mind that he was going to be pure even under these circumstances. That's an important thing for us to understand. Well, something else I think kind of jumps out of the text is that Daniel persisted in his efforts to not defile himself. If you're reading along with me in Daniel, the first chapter, we've read verse 8. Now look at verse 9. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. Now my impression is that the chief of the eunuchs, the guy that Daniel goes to first, he basically denies the request. I don't understand why he would say what's recorded in verse 9 if he was just going to agree to it. What he's telling Daniel is, I'm afraid to do what you're asking me to do because, you know, if you guys don't look as good as the others, I'm the one whose head is on the chopping block. I'm mixing figures like a madman tonight. But Daniel doesn't quit. Because in verse 11 it says, so Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and then he makes his request to the steward. Now maybe I'm missing something. Maybe the chief of the eunuchs did not deny the request, and the steward's just the one who puts it into effect. I suppose that's a possibility. It just seems unlikely in view of verse 9. And I suggest to you that the more probable case is that the chief of the eunuchs said, you know what, this is too risky. I'm not going to take responsibility for this. And Daniel wouldn't give up. Because if you notice in verse 11, he's not talking to the same person. He's now talking to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs, that's who he talked to in the first place, now he's talking to the one who's under the chief of the eunuchs. So Daniel started at the top, but when that didn't work out, Daniel continued. He persisted in his efforts to try to make sure that he didn't defile himself with the king's food, the king's delicacies. Now, as it turned out, Daniel was successful. I've read a commentary or two on Daniel that suggested that the steward was all too happy to oblige Daniel because he could keep the good food and give Daniel the vegetables and water and pocket the difference. And that may be what happened. I don't think Daniel was concerned about that, do you? In fact, I would even suggest to you that Daniel was prepared to go without food before he would defile himself. That seems obvious from the character of this man. But his efforts were successful, and you know the rest of the story. For our purposes this evening, we've already made the two points, and that is that Daniel purposed in his heart what he was going to do. He's going to stay pure, and then he acted on that purpose, and he persisted in his actions until he was successful in resisting this difficulty, this temptation. What I'd like to do now is I'd like to go to chapter 3, and if you'll pardon me, we're going to change horses in midstream here and look at another thing that happens here in the book of Daniel, this time focusing on the other three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We are told in chapter 3 that Nebuchadnezzar set up a golden image. It was 60 cubits high. 60 cubits is approximately 90 feet. And it was 6 cubits across. It's 9 feet across. This was a huge golden image. Now, in the picture, which is just an artist's reconstruction of what he thought it looked like, it's an image of the king, and I think that's probably accurate. And everybody's bowing down because that was the instruction of the king. He set up this golden image, and then he called a bunch of important people together, including Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This is in verse 2 of chapter 3. He sent word to gather together, that is, the king did, the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. We're told back in the end of chapter 1 that these four men, Daniel and his three companions, they've all been given positions of prominence in the government, in the administration there. They're serving the king. And so in this summons of chapter 3 and verse 2, very likely that these three men would all have come, been summoned. I'm not sure where Daniel was. He's not mentioned in the story. I don't know what we can conclude about that. Probably nothing. But at any rate, the instruction is when everybody gets together, they're going to dedicate the image. And verse 4 says, a herald cried aloud when all these people were gathered together, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And we're actually told what the consequence is if you don't bow down to the image. Verse 6 says, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And so the music plays. According to verse 7, and you know, I was looking at this picture, and there's a problem with this picture. Can you see what it is? Everybody's bowing. Except these guys back here. I don't know, maybe these are supposed to be Shadrach and Meshach, and I don't know where Abednego is. Off to bed he went. But everybody else out here is bowing. Now, understand the context. This is the dedication of the image. It's not, you know, you're passing by and the music happens to play, so you fall down, but nobody else is around. All these important people have gathered together, and they're going to dedicate the image, and the music plays, and everybody falls down. And I'll tell you what, if you're Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you suddenly feel rather conspicuous because you're very likely the only ones who haven't bowed down. You know, most people just are not all that keen on being thrown into a fiery furnace. And so here are these three guys that are standing and they refuse to worship the golden image because that's wrong. Shall have no other gods before me. Shall not worship any graven image. That's law of Moses. These people were living under that law. These three men were still living under that law. And so it's interesting that in verse 8 we're told that certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. Now I think this is kind of interesting because here are these four men, Daniel and his three friends, and they're all way up there in terms of authority and influence in the Babylonian government, and it's Chaldeans who come and accuse the Jews. Because you see, if those guys get thrown in the fiery furnace, guess what? There are some positions now available. There are some openings in the government. And so the Chaldeans come forward and accuse the Jews. I will make this note. Chaldean, in some cases, can refer to the magicians or the soothsayers, may not have just been government officials. Be aware of that. But here's what they say to King Nebuchadnezzar: O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree, and they remind him of what the law is. There are certain Jews, verse 12 continues, whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are their names. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. And Nebuchadnezzar is furious. You can just see, perhaps imagine in your mind's eye, here's the king who is beside himself. He's red-faced, he's upset, he's just absolutely furious that these guys would have the gall to do that. And he sends immediately, gives the command to bring these three men. So they brought these men before the king. This is verse 13, 14. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I've set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear, he's giving them a second chance. What was the law? If you didn't bow down, what was supposed to happen to you? Immediately cast into the fiery furnace. But I think this king, even in his rage, understands the character of the people he's talking about, talking to. And he says, if you're ready, but if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Now, these are three men who literally stood up for right. They would not bow down to this image. And what we read in verses 16 and following is that these three men were prepared to pay the cost. They answered the king in verse 16, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. We don't have to rationale or reason this out. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, and that's important, because what that tells me is that the Lord had not conveyed to them any promise that they were going to be spared from the fiery furnace. These guys don't know whether they're going to live or die when they go into the fiery furnace, because they're not certain that God's even going to spare them. And yet, in spite of that, listen to what they say. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. O king, if God decides to save us, he can. But even if he doesn't, we're not going to serve this image. We're not going to commit idolatry. These are men who are prepared to pay the cost of staying pure. Now, the wonderful thing about the story is that God does keep them safe. And I think that has to do with the history of Israel and God making provisions for these men to help preserve the nation, bless the nation. Eventually the nation's going to be, at least some will return to the land. That's another story and another sermon. But the important thing is, they didn't know what the cost might be, but they were prepared to pay it if necessary. Now, of course, the whole reason that we're talking about these guys is that we can apply the same strategy that these young men used to the temptations from the world that we face. We need to purpose in our hearts, just like they did. We need to make up our minds what we're going to do in the moment of temptation before the temptation is presented. If you read today's bulletin article, the front page article had to do with temptation. And it used the figure, the analogy of a fisherman, suggesting that Satan is one who in temptation he casts the bait. And he knows what's good bait for us. He perhaps has already decided what's good bait for you in particular based on your weakness, and the same thing would be true of me. He knows the kinds of weaknesses that we have as creatures, human creatures. And he casts the bait that is tempting, that is the most interesting. Just like a fisherman who, with a different fish, he uses a different kind of bait. Sin has its passing pleasure. The book of Hebrews in chapter 11, if you wish to turn over there, has some things to say about Moses. Moses, of course, was raised in a privileged position, raised in the house of Pharaoh by Pharaoh's daughter. But the Bible says in chapter 11, verse 24, by faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. You know, the fact of the matter is, if the preacher tells you that sin isn't fun, he's lying. Because the fact of the matter is, sin is often pleasurable for the moment. That's why it says here the passing pleasures of sin. Because then later on you have to pay the cost. You have to pay the price for the pleasure. But Satan knows that so many things look so good in the moment. And unless you have already decided what you're going to do in that kind of circumstance, you may decide to enjoy the pleasure. I don't know how many of you have this same experience, but I am trying to lose a little bit of weight. I've gained some weight over the last 2 or 3 years. More than I wish to. And, you know, I'll think, well, I'm gonna lose some weight. That's just a little too vague. That's a little too general. You got to be more specific. You got a purpose in your heart a little more specifically than that. Because, you know, when you go to the restaurant and there's that cheesecake there, everything that you know about calories and health and weight loss and all that stuff, fitness, you know, physical fitness, you know that's a no-no. Cheesecake just not on the weight loss diet. But I love cheesecake. And so does Debbie. So she's absolutely no help. And so in the moment, you begin to think and rationalize about, you know, I could probably just eat one piece after all. I ate pretty light yesterday. And tomorrow I'll eat light. And so you just go ahead and eat that cheesecake because you don't want to think about the consequences. You just want to taste the cheesecake. And then after you eat the cheesecake, what are you thinking to yourself? Why did I do that? That was so dumb. There's probably 16 bazillion calories in that thing. But you ate it already. Now you got to start from scratch again. I got tickled at Ralph when he was giving his invitation last Wednesday. I sensed some frustration in Ralph as he talked about the coffee pot. You may be sensing a little frustration in me at this point. But do you see the point? Satan knows that if he just presents it as enjoyable, fun, pleasurable, he doesn't have to worry about down the road because too many people think with their emotions. And they make decisions at the spur of the moment based on the attractiveness of the sin. What Daniel did is he made a decision up front about what he was going to do with respect to foods that defile. I'm not eating it. Period. And that's really what we need to do. Sin has its passing pleasure, but we need to decide to forego that pleasure. Emotions have a way of washing over unsettled decisions. Young people, I'm telling you, you need to think about what your response is going to be when you are presented with the option of immorality. Make your decision now. Know what you're going to do before you ever get there. And it's so much easier than to follow through with that decision because your mind's not so clouded with emotions at the time, or at least that's a possibility. Secondly, just like these Daniel, we need to be persistent in our efforts. No half-hearted resistance to the pressures of the world. Can I give you an illustration? I don't know how many of you have had this experience. I know some of the young people have because I've talked to them about it. You're looking for a part-time job. Maybe you're a teenager. For David Silvernail, that's been several years ago. He's hit 21 again this last week. But maybe he remembers, like I remember, that you go to the place where you want to get a job, and the first thing you tell the manager is, I can't work on Sundays. I got to go to church. I go to church on Sundays. I'm not going to work on Sundays. And you know what the manager will always tell you? Hey, that's not a problem. Don't worry about that. We just won't schedule you on Sundays. And when the first work schedule comes out, what do you know about that schedule? You will be on Sunday. Do you know why? He wants to know just how committed you are to that. I've seen it again. It must be management school stuff. There must be a rule somewhere in, you know, a master of business administration, that if somebody says, I can't work on that day, schedule him the first schedule on that day and see if he'll follow through on his commitment. You know what Christians need to do? They need to march to the manager and say, listen, I'm going to be an excellent employee for you. I'm going to be on time. I'm going to work. And I'm going to be honest. But I told you, I don't work on Sundays. You've got a choice. You can either take me off a Sunday or I'm looking for another job. And now he knows that you have purposed in your heart and you're serious about what you said in terms of your commitment. Young people, do it. Because if you don't, the manager knows that he can push you anywhere he wants to push you. And I don't believe there's any job that important. Do you? Do you need to keep it under those circumstances? And I'm going to tell you something else about being persistent in your efforts. It's easy to get discouraged because sometimes the people that you think ought to be right there by your side helping you be pure, helping you do the right thing because they made the same commitment in the past that you do, are not going to be there. They're going to be the ones who are going to let you down. I'm talking about your peers. I'm talking about other Christians sometimes. I don't care if you're going to a Bible school. I don't care if you're going to a college where most of the people are Christians. You're going to find people who are going to let you down. People who ought to be doing the right thing are not going to be the ones who are going to support you. And I got to tell you, that's discouraging. But I want you to think about Daniel. I want you to think about Daniel before he got to Babylon, when he was still back in Judah, and he was looking around at God's people, people who were people of the book, of the covenant, who should have been living pure, holy lives as dictated by the law of Moses, and they were as wicked or worse than the people around them. You think that wasn't discouraging to Daniel at times? But you don't see Daniel giving up, do you? And that's a temptation. It's easy to say, well, you know, if nobody else is going to do it, then I don't know that I can do it either. Maybe the people next door to you, theoretically, you know, figuratively speaking, maybe they're watching to see what you're going to do. You can be the encouragement to them instead of discouraging them. Well, last of all, we need to be prepared to pay the cost. There's often a very real cost to be paid for living a pure life. And I'm not going to get into all of that. I think you know sometimes that it can cost you. It can cost you friendships. You can be ostracized by the people that you really want to associate with or that you need to spend time with, and they just kind of shun you because you're a goody-two-shoes or you're a Pharisee or something of that nature. Or you're a nerd. Or you're afraid. Or any number of things that people will say about you because you have decided to do the right thing. And that hurts. Don't pretend that it doesn't. I know it does. It can cost you your job to do the right thing. It could cost you your marriage, I guess. There's costs sometimes that have to be paid if you're going to do the right thing. And if we're going to stay pure living in an unclean world, then we need to be prepared to pay the cost. What the Lord needs is courageous disciples, not fearful disciples. Well, as I noted this morning, we live in a culture which is very worldly. And I'm going to kind of skim through just a few things, but I just want you to think about the kinds of pressures and temptations that not just young people face, We older adults also face these things. Pornography is a real and present danger in our society. It's killing the church in many places. And I'm not going to even try to offer up statistics, but from an anecdotal standpoint, you just start hearing more and more about this brother and that brother and this person, and it's not just men. It's women too, whose lives and marriages and families are being destroyed. Their eternal futures are being destroyed by pornography. It's very easy to access, and the internet provides private access as much as that is possible, I guess. Pornography involves exploitation. And frankly, it fits perfectly the definition of uncleanness and lewdness. And those are two words that are included in the works of the flesh in Galatians 5. And Paul's just very blunt about this. He says, that'll keep you out of heaven. So understand that if you're involved in pornography, you are taking the cheesecake because it looks good for the moment. And the price is going to be so high. You're giving up so much for the moment. I'll tell you something else about pornography. Like so much sin, it is deceptive. And here's how it's deceptive. I was reading just recently some comments, blurbs at the end, posts at the end of an article written by Brent Buzzell. He was commenting on the channel, the cable television channel, G4. G4 is just trash. So much of what they have on there in terms of their regular programming is just not fit for anybody to watch. And he was commenting on that. He was commenting that on Valentine's Day, they threw away the romance and they played trash all day long. Some sort of conference or something off in Australia that was basically just a pornography conference. And that's the kind of stuff that... But what was interesting was how many of the posts written by people who read the article were defending pornography. If you don't want to watch it, don't watch it. It's freedom of speech, and on and on and on it went. I'll tell you how pornography is deceptive. It's subject to the law of diminishing returns, like so many things. And by that I simply mean that people who are satisfied with a little bit of raciness and a little risque material, after a while, that's not good enough anymore. It's not interesting. So you just kind of go the next level. And you know the process. Then you go the next level, and then you go the next level. And I'll tell you what happens. After a while, people aren't interested in watching anymore. They want to do. And it's killing Christians, right and left. It's an epidemic among brethren. We need to look at the strategy that we've talked about. Purpose in our hearts that that's something that we don't need to have a part about in, and we're just not going to engage in it. We need to be persistent, keep reminding ourselves of the cost, and be prepared to pay the cost if you have to. If it means getting rid of your computer or getting rid of your internet, and I don't know that that's necessary, I'm not making laws here. Those of you who are this morning perhaps remember the illustration. What I'm saying is you do whatever you have to do to enter into life. Jesus said that, didn't he? If your hand causes you to sin, what did he say? Cut it off. He's not suggesting that you mutilate yourself or that I cut off my foot, because the hand isn't really the issue. What he's saying is whatever it takes for you to enter into life, that's the sacrifice you need to make. Pay the cost. Be prepared to pay the cost. Brethren, I've run out of time, but not out of items. I think you see the point. I'm going to just allow pornography to be an illustration of the greater principle. And we'll talk about some of the other things that I had in mind on another occasion. But all of these things need to be confronted the same way. They're all challenges. There are challenges to all of us, not just young people. It's challenges to older people too. We need to know how to confront worldliness in our lives. Well, let me conclude this evening by making this observation. The Pharisees, as we studied this morning, they constructed a lot of laws that they used to try to avoid the influence of worldliness through Greek culture. Let me say once again, I don't think the Pharisees started out to be hypocrites. They had a noble goal, they just took the wrong path to reach it. And where they found themselves by first century Palestine is where that path always leads. Hypocrisy, failure to understand what righteousness really is about, elevating man's law above God's law, all of those things. You can't start with regulating the outside. You have to start with the heart. You have to start with the inside. We need a purpose in our hearts. And here's the question we need to ask. What kind of people do we want to be? What kind of person do you want to be? I'm not talking about whether you want to be an engineer, a doctor, or whatever like that. I'm saying, what kind of person spiritually do you want to be? Do you want to be a person who, kind of person who's living a lie day after day, afraid that someone's going to find out how worldly I really am? I'm just kind of trying to hold off the brethren so they don't discover who I really am. There's people who live their lives like that, and it's a horrible way to live, I would think. Do you want to be the kind of person, in contrast, who's pure and clean and whose life can be viewed without fear of the discovery of things that are unsavory? Because I've got to tell you something. You can't hide anything from God. Your life is an open book, just like mine, whether we really want it that way or not. Now, maybe we can fool brethren. Maybe we can even fool family members or whoever, but at some point, you need to understand you can't fool God. The Lord has a means of cleaning us up after we have gotten ourselves stained, soiled with sin. In the book of Revelation, in chapter 7, John saw two groups. He saw the 144,000 Jews who were sealed. But he saw another group, and they are described briefly in the latter part of chapter 7. One of the elders asked John, "Who are these people?" And John said in verse 14, "Sir, you know." So he said to me, "These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." God's, or I should say Christ's blood, can cleanse us from every stay. Do you need to be cleansed tonight? The Lord says that those who believe in His Son as the Son of God, Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God, and who are willing to repent of their sins, that if confession is made with the mouth, those people can be baptized, immersed in water, buried with Christ into death, into His death, and into their death. So that when they come up out of the water, they rise to walk in newness of life. Clean. If that's your need this evening, then we invite you, we encourage you as we stand and sing. If you'll come to the front, we'll assist you in whatever way possible. Will you surrender to Christ?